This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our weekly director's cut of the show, a selection of curated conversations from the archive. First, from Charleston, South Carolina to Washington, D.C., we'll take a closer look at the U.S. Civil Rights Trail. Then, child development experts worry skipping a grade can be harmful to a gifted student's social and emotional health, but not accelerating that child does harm too. Also, wild horse herds that roam the American West are growing out of control. Is birth control an option? That's ahead on Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History just opened a new exhibit honoring Emmett Till, the 14-year-old black boy who was brutally murdered in August of 1955. His killing helped to mobilize the civil rights movement. The Smithsonian exhibit focuses on how racism continues to hamper efforts to publicly commemorate Emmett Till. Historical markers about Till's murder are frequently stolen, defaced, or become riddled with bullet holes. Many historic sites significant to the civil rights movement are not well marked or curated for visitors, which is why journalist Deborah Douglas wrote U.S. Civil Rights Trail, A Traveler's Guide to the People, Places, and Events That Made the Movement. I spoke with Douglas back in January, and we started by talking about the location of another murder, the home where civil rights leader Medgar Evers was gunned down in his driveway by a member of the KKK in 1963. What's it like to visit the Evers home in Jackson, Mississippi?
Oh, there's a rush of emotions. Of course, sadness and knowing what happened there. When you first walk into the house, you go through the actual driveway where he was gunned down. But you also see signs of family life. You know, you see the children's mattresses low on the floor because he didn't want bullets to whiz through the windows at night and hurt the children. You see worn toys. So you got the sense of joy and intimacy of family life, but also just the feeling of sadness that he was cut down the way he was for the reasons he was cut down.
He was an NAACP worker, right? Leader, organizer in Mississippi.
Yes, he was a field director, and he went around the state and he collected stories of racism and discrimination and got people to go on the record and advocated on their behalf and organized people to raise their voices and fight for freedom.
And in what way was his assassination important, you know, notable to the movement, such that preserving his home is an important part of this trail?
For so many reasons. First of all, Medgar Evers was a veteran. And like so many of the people who were a part of the movement, a lot of these soldiers came back home. They fought for American freedom, and they fully expected to come home and take part in the democratic experiment. But when they came back, they were treated the way that Black people had always been treated. And so people don't talk a lot about the direct connection of what those soldiers experienced to the civil rights movement, but I think a lot of the tension and anger and agitation of being locked out of society is part of the energy that fueled the movement.
Is visiting historical sites related to the civil rights movement something that you've always done?
I can't say that I've always done it, because when you look at sort of like travel logs or catalogs, or you look at what cities and states are saying about, you know, places that you should visit, they don't necessarily put Black neighborhoods, Black stories, or communities in those narratives. So this is why this book is different, because it elevates the lived experience of African Americans to be on par with that kind of travel. I think that I've been reflecting a little bit more deeply on the history that is just right around me at all times. I live in Chicago, and the home that Emmett Till lived in is on track to be recognized as a historical monument for the city of Chicago. And I think that I could do a better job of cherishing the history that surrounds me, and I encourage other people to do so too.
You mentioned Emmett Till. There is a site in the book, your guidebook, that you recommend people visit and observe a moment of silence. But the site itself is not that much to look at. It's a falling down old store. It's the remains of a grocery
Yes.
store in the Mississippi Delta. Tell us about that location. Do you remember the first time you visited it? Was it difficult to find?
Well, I had some help when I drove into the Delta from Jackson, which is to the south. I actually made calls ahead so people would know that I was coming. And I met with the state senator, David Jordan, at the Greenwood City Hall and talked to him about the town, the area, directions of places to go. And Senator Jordan actually attended the trial of Medgar Evers's murder. So I wanted to document his story in that way. And so I drove up to Money Road and I plotted it on a map the night before on my friend's kitchen table in Jackson. And there is not much to look at. And the day that I was there, it was blocked off by an orange gate. And it was marked by a sign. And then there's another store that is that's been preserved better in that period that kind of gives you a sense of the architecture of the time. If you read the signs, you get a sense of, you know, the communication style at the time. But really, you can kind of feel the spectral energy of the time. So this is really something that you should stop and contemplate and think about your positionality. What if you were a kid like Emmett and his cousins? What must have been going through Carolyn Bryant's mind when she formulated that lie in her mind, or the men, the white men in the store?
So this is the, if you would just tell us the story quickly, what is it about Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market that in Greenwood, mm-hmm. Mississippi, that is significant to the movement?
Well, Emmett, who was 14 at the time, was on summer vacation down from Chicago. And he went into the store with his cousins that day. The store is owned by Carolyn Bryant, and I think her husband's name is Jim. I forget his name. Anyway, she reported to her husband that Emmett whistled at her, which was a no-no back in that time. And, you know, as is now, Black children were deemed to not be children, but, you know, fashioned as adults. And they came... her husband and some other men came and pulled Emmett out of his house where he was living with family members that summer. Mm-hmm. And they went and they drove and found, they abused him. And they found a cotton gin fan with barbed wire and wrapped it around him and threw him in the river. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how his body was found. And so one of the sites in the book is the actual cotton gin where they got the device to weigh his body down. And that museum, it's a small museum, is actually run by one of the men whose fathers helped move the body, a Black man who didn't really have the power and agency to say no, that he wouldn't help with a terrible job like that. So it's really like rich and layered and spooky and terrible.
Yeah. And Emmett Till was murdered in 1955. You mentioned in the book that his murder was really in some ways considered a catalyst of the modern civil rights movement.
Yes, it was a catalyst for the modern day civil rights movement. Sorry to cut you off.
Please. No, good. I appreciate you affirming that for me. The U.S. Civil Rights Trail that you lay out, if one wanted to, you could spend a good long time tracing the entire trail by car and visiting all of the sites. That would probably take weeks, months to do that, depending on how fast.
It would take a month. I counted it up. It would take a month. Okay. And I'm not suggesting that people take a month off because most of us don't have that. But this trail is really amenable to day trips and weekend trips. And you can go spend, you know, a couple days in a city, or if you wanted to take a couple days over, maybe have a long weekend, you can say go from Memphis to Nashville or Memphis to the Delta or Birmingham to Montgomery. Mm. There's lots of different ways to slice and dice it. And I give very specific instructions in the book on how to do that.
You've mentioned some of the locations that we know from major events in the civil rights movement, Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma. The trail, though, starts in Charleston, South Carolina. Why did you choose that as the starting place?
Okay, so the official civil rights trail, I must say, and this was designated by Southern Travel Directors in 2018, so this is why it's so new. It actually starts as far east as Wilmington, Delaware, And it can go as far west as Kansas, as far south as deep into Florida and Louisiana. But I had to make some choices. So I go to Charleston because I needed a foundational chapter. How did Black people get into this country? Why are African Americans here in the first place? Charleston was one of the largest ports for enslaved Africans. So it was foundational in that way. And there are other things that happened in Charleston, too. You know, labor movement, and of course now what happened at Mother Emanuel. So, but foundationally, Charleston is important for those reasons.
Yeah, and the trail ends in Washington, D.C. The White House is even a stop on it. Why?
Well, African Americans built the White House. Enslaved Africans helped build the White House, and free Black people helped build the White House. So that's one reason why it literally is our house, and it's our house in the sense of for the citizens of the United States, it's our house. And Washington is important is because everything starts and ends there in terms of defining who we are, how we are, and why we are. Think about the Supreme Court cases. Think about the laws that were made as a result of the movement, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, Housing Act, so much came out of that movement that traces its way back to Washington, D.C. And then D.C. in and of itself, you know, was a place for the Black freedom struggle, too. So I don't want to erase the fact that D.C., Black D.C. residents were agitating for their own freedoms as citizens of that town.
Like all good guidebooks, your guidebook, the U.S. Civil Rights Trail, includes recommendations for where to eat and where to sleep and lots of great historical information and photos and recommended day trips and walking tours and all kinds of things, right? It's a literal guidebook, which is really cool. I loved the addition, though, of recommended playlist for the various stops along the way. And I want to listen to one of them. So this is a song called We've Got a Job. It was written by Black composer Carlton Reese. And I have a clip here of it being performed by the Carlton Reese Memorial Unity Choir at a live event marking the 50th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Let's listen to just a bit.
I've got a job.
I've got a job.
And we want you to know.
You've got a job.
All of God's children.
All of God's children.
Surely.
Deborah Douglas, if we were on this road trip together, where would you decide to cue that song for us?
Oh, when you get to Birmingham, because the Carlton Reese Choir was born as a choir of the Alabama movement, Christian Movement for Human Rights, which was founded by Reverend Fred Lee Shuttlesworth. And so movement leaders like Reverend Shuttlesworth deem music as being sort of like a way to generate energy and momentum. And so, you know, while you're working to live right and get to heaven, you just sort of like took some of that message and, you know, and flowed it into the quest to get right and live right on earth. Mm-hmm. And the Carlton Reese Choir actually exists today.
Really? Okay. And
yes.
and the 16th Street Baptist Church, where the bombing took place that killed four girls, is that church visitable? Is it still there?
Totally visible.
Huh.
Yes. So it's actually in the Civil Rights District in downtown Birmingham. You can call the church or go online and make arrangements to visit the church, visit the sanctuary, and then you'll visit the basement also. Across from that is the Civil Rights Institute. Is a museum, and it fully contextualized the lived experience of Black Alabamans at the time and what they were fighting for. And it gives you a little sense of the economy of Birmingham. I just learned so much there. Hmm. And then across the street is the Kelly Ingram Park, which was a staging area for a lot of the protests. And inside that park, you have all kinds of monuments, a monument to the four little girls. You see the water cannons, a replica water cannon that was used to spray children, child activists at that time, and some other things too.
How has there been any challenge in making sure that these sites are preserved and maintained and that these stories, like who's making sure that you know, who's making these museums and maintaining these sites?
A lot of the museums I went to were Smithsonian affiliated. And like in the case of the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, I know they do get corporate sponsorship. I did notice a greater appreciation for the story. Like every state I went to, there was a museum to go to, for example, a very well appointed museum.
Does that surprise you?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I knew about a couple of them, but then, you know, the idea that I could go any place and then walk into this narrative and in this context was beautiful. And there's more on tap. There's going to be a new African-American museum in Charleston that focuses on the slave trade and genealogy. The Mormon Church actually donated a lot of money to bolster the genealogical research apparatus of that museum that will open in 2022. And the Department of Interior maintains a lot of sites. So a lot of the sites that the federal government actually runs are in this book, too. So we have that investment.
How can people make sure that they're seeing these sites in modern context, that it's not just visiting a place where interesting things happened 50 years ago?
I mean, I don't want to sound like overly commercial, but the opportunity that I took in my book is to put the history in a modern context. I do make a point, even though it's a guidebook and it says go here, eat this and eat that, it's also, it has an analysis to it at the same time, and it connects it to modern day movements. I go all the way up into, you know, the uprisings of 2020. So by the time you put it down, if you can't figure out where you stand on the issues, I don't know, maybe you need to read it again.
Who was this guidebook for? Was there a specific person in your life or that you've encountered that you thought, I hope they use this?
There are categories of people. So people who love history, people who are American history buffs, all African-Americans, all white progressives, people who consider themselves allies and advocates, children. I bumped into busloads of children as I was making this trip. Many times they let me get on the bus and take a ride with them. So it's good for children. And it's a good baseline to understand the narrative arc of the mid-century civil rights movement. A lot of us know, you know, pieces of it. A lot of us know more than other people do. But this is in one book. It goes city by city. And I painstakingly put together city by city timelines so you can understand the historical context of the movement in those cities. And then you get a chance to see how the puzzles fit together and you understand better what people were fighting for.
Is there one site that that's maybe well known because it's a location where terrible things happened or a famous protest happened, but that when people visit it, they'll be surprised, like that maybe it'll really kind of change the way they see things?
Ooh, that is interesting. That's a big question. It's so many places like that. I mean, I guess when you go, the idea that four little girls could be bombed at 16th Street Baptist Church in church on a day when the children were, you know, having a special program, you know, you could put yourself in that space, putting on your best clothes. Maybe you've rehearsed a speech or something, or some sort of way you're just partaking in the leadership of this worship and community space. That was heartbreaking. But I also found out the same day that those girls were murdered, two Black boys in town were murdered that same day for different reasons that had to do with racism. So they lost six children in that community that day, not just those four.
Deborah Douglas, it sounds like there are many places that are sacred on this trail for you. Is there one spot that is particularly inspiring, makes you feel hopeful?
I love the African-American Museum in Washington, D.C. I go there all the time. I mean, literally, I go to D.C. for work a lot, and then I just go over there for lunch. because when you go into the dining area, they have these different stands that give different interpretations of African-American cuisine, like coastal cuisine, or basic soul food or just all sorts of things. So it's almost like you could just go eat there and tour the Black experience in that way. Hmm. But then the rest of the museum is just a place you just want to get yourself lost in. And it's just done at the highest quality. So you feel so respected and cared for when you're in that edifice.
Deborah Douglas is a visiting professor of journalism at DePaul University, author of U.S. Civil Rights Trail, A Traveler's Guide to the People, Places, and Events That Made the Movement. We spoke in January. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Coming up in about 15 minutes, wild horse herds that roam the American West are growing out of control. Are contraceptives an option? Just ahead, child development experts worry skipping a grade may harm a gifted student's social and emotional health, but not accelerating that child does harm too. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly staff picks version of the show. A child who's really smart or learns really quickly could take advanced classes, skip a grade, or graduate early. But there's long been a concern that academic acceleration like that could negatively affect a child's social and emotional well-being. To find out, a research team followed children who academically accelerated for more than 35 years, well into adulthood for those kids. David Lubinsky is co-author of the research. He's a professor of psychology and human development at Vanderbilt University, and he spoke with Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett about their findings last fall.
So these kids were identified at age 13 and then were followed up with a couple times until age 50. How did they compare to other people psychologically?
So we did a 35-year study on three cohorts of intellectually talented kids who were in the top 1% of either quantitative or verbal reasoning abilities. And we used a host of markers of psychological well-being, psychological flourishing, positive emotionality. The measures that are typically done in psychological well-being studies for adult populations and cross-cultural studies. And we found no evidence that kids with more acceleration relative to the others were psychologically harmed in any way.
So even at age 50, when you followed up, they were just doing
the same. Absolutely. In fact, we even replicated this with a distinct high potential sample. We have another cohort of top STEM graduate students. These are 714 STEM graduate students who attended the top STEM programs in the country as graduate students. And we assessed them in their first and second year of graduate school. We collected information on their educational histories, how much they accelerated, whether they skipped grades, et cetera. And we followed them up at age 52. And we found no evidence that their psychological well-being was harmed in any way as a function of the extent to which they accelerated. So in an independent sample, we replicated our findings.
Did any of the people that you studied wish that they hadn't accelerated?
There are always examples on both sides of the fence. So you will find a few examples like that, people with regrets. But by and large, the general trend is people wish they were accelerated more.
Huh. So for the purposes of this study, these studies, these different cohorts they used, how did you identify academic acceleration? Was it only if they skipped a grade or if they took AP classes or graduated earlier, or kind of a combination of all three?
A combination. And we used two measures. We used density of acceleration and also something people don't think about. But sometimes when kids are precocious, parents and teachers agree to start them earlier than usual in kindergarten. So we also looked at age of high school graduation in addition to whether they skipped a grade, whether they took AP courses, whether they took college courses when they were in high school. So we had a variety of measures to triangulate acceleration in multiple ways, and we didn't find any differences.
So those are the long-term effects, but what about short-term effects on children when they're accelerating in school?
We have other studies that address this. These we have a major study that was published in 2004 on the AP exam, kids who experienced AP courses in high school versus those that didn't. We have a 2010 piece on what we call educational dose, kids who had a larger dose of accelerative experiences relative to the others who were commensurate in ability. And what we find, see, we conceptualize the concept of educational dose because when parents and teachers and principals find that certain programs work, they automatically want it for their kids and students. And no school can do everything. So we conceptualized educational dose very comparable to how an optimal diet is conceptualized or an optimal exercise program is conceptualized. Parents can provide their kids with wonderful diets. They don't ever have to eat lima beans or they don't ever have to eat broccoli. You can do all kinds of combinations. It's the same with an exercise program. When you consult with your physician on an optimal diet or exercise program, there are multiple things you can do. You never have to do a stationary bike or you never have to swim, but there are all kinds of different things that are functionally equivalent. So we conceptualized educational dose that way and formed a composite of educational dose and looked at kids who got more versus less, and we didn't. And we found that kids who get more have a greater likelihood of a variety of creative contributions and educational achievements. And we looked at things like scientific publications. We looked at things like patents. We looked at things like advanced degrees. You have to look at a lot of different things because there are multiple ways to be successful in life. And it's not just because of advanced degrees. Some people value other things more. Income more, for example, how they feel about their life. So we looked at a variety of outcome criteria, and we found benefits for acceleration in terms of concrete achievements.
I'm speaking with David Lubinsky. He's a professor of psychology and human development at Vanderbilt University. Professor Lubinsky, isn't there still, though, some question in the short term about things like if it's better for a child to, you know, just be a kid, you know, and not have to be worrying so much about, you know, accelerating and taking AP classes or skipping a grade?
Of course. And actually, that's what we aim for. And we're always evaluating psychological well-being. Professionals always talk to children to make sure that they want to accelerate and to make sure that they have the prerequisites to do so. Because some kids are more talented overall. Some kids are just talented in mathematical reasoning. Some kids are just talented in verbal reasoning or reading. And it depends on the individuality of the kid, the maturity level. So, for example, girls are because they mature more quickly, are more likely to be ready for educational acceleration at age 12 or age 13 relative to boys. And actually, for summer residential programs for intellectually talented youth, although they're evaluated very positive, this is where kids come to residential programs like at Duke TIP or CTY or Vanderbilt's PTY, and they take a full high school course in 3 weeks' time. And we not only look at how they did academically, but we look at how they feel about the programs, and they tend to love it. But the girls tend to love it a little more. And if you think about it, when you're a 12-year-old girl in seventh grade and you're mathematically precocious and the agenda is to fit in, typical school settings often aren't comfortable for them. So when they come to summer residential programs, they're not only surrounded by their intellectual peers who love math, they don't have to worry about suppressing their vocabulary anymore. Hmm. People get their jokes, and they love it.
So the happy fish, little pond idea isn't really always true for these kids.
No, it might happen. It might happen for some kids, but they're the exceptions. They're the exceptions. Most people are happier with their intellectual peers, and if you think about it. And it's an important issue to talk about now because it's going to intensify over time. The Atlantic has even had some stories about it for the popular press. Given innovations with the internet and more access in public libraries, intellectually talented kids are starting to take courses online, and more are showing up for high school already having mastered the whole mathematical curriculum. What are you going to do with these kids? Because they have had access. They're not ready for – they're beyond what their high school affords in that domain. Mm. So we have to make adjustments.
And would the same be true then for kids who skip grades, that even though they're not among kids of their own age, peers that way, it may be better for them to be among academic intellectual peers?
Yes, it tends to be the case. It tends to be the case. There are exceptions. It has to be done individually with each student to see if it's a good idea to accelerate. But sometimes, no matter what you do, certain components are going to be suboptimal, but it's the net effect. What's the best thing to do overall? And we've developed a lot of procedures to help with this.
See, yeah, I was going to ask, how do you decide what's the best thing for the child?
Well, first of all, you have to look at their individuality. You have to look, are they talented in one area? If it's just one area, say it's just math, then there's no need to skip a grade. You can provide them with advanced learning opportunities in that area to excel, but keep them in class with their chronological peers. The concept is that they should be in coursework with their intellectual peers. It's not unlike college. You think of how we structure the curriculum in universities. When a professor is approached by a student who wants to take an advanced course, a professor never asks the student how old they are. They ask them if they have the prerequisites. Mm-hmm. If they do, they can take the course. And that's what we should do for gifted kids. And the nice thing about it is oftentimes this doesn't cost anything extra. All they need is access to programs that are already in place that were designed for older kids.
Hmm. Is that the same then of how you would decide how a parent would help decide if a student should take things like college courses or AP classes or graduate early, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in consultation with their child, because sometimes students want to work more alone, on their own, or in a group, or on projects. So it's really individually tailored. Years ago, we didn't have as much for gifted kids 50, 40 years ago. It was just grade skipping or nothing. Now we have AP courses. People are sensitive to kids taking community college classes. We have summer residential programs for intellectually talented youth. We have mentorships. There are a variety of things that students can choose from now. And it's different kids have different needs.
Is there ever a time when a kid shouldn't accelerate academically? Even if they could, they have the intellectual capability.
Sure. I mean, it depends on other non-intellectual attributes in terms of whether or not they would be emotionally ready and mature to do so. And it's always good to get a school psychologist involved, because who can look at their kids objectively? We try as much as we can. And it's so hard to say, because there are so many low base rate phenomenon that would warrant maybe not accelerating a child. So if the child was highly resistant, or there was an emotional concern or whatever, there could be multiple things. But it's best to consult a school psychologist in coming to this decision.
What would those flags be that a parent should look for to know if their child is ready?
How are they doing in a particular area relative to their peers? How passionate are they about it? How much they crave it? A lot of times gifted kids will say, I want more of this. I want to do this. And they will seek out an environment. So provide them with opportunities and see what they do with it. For example, here's a neglected talent. We have a line of research that has shown that a neglected talent, Nora Newcomb at Temple University, refers to spatial ability as the orphan ability, because it's neglected. We do a pretty good job of identifying kids who are verbally precocious or mathematically precocious. But kids who are gifted in spatial visualization, a skill that's very important for engineering, architecture, piloting, dentistry, orthopedic surgery, that's an inconspicuous talent. And these are kids who are extroverted for things. They like to manipulate. They gravitate toward shop courses, cooking, building. They like Legos. Kids like that are often turned off by typical high school curriculum, because it's focused on verbal and quantitative reasoning. They like to build things. They like to build bridges.
That's David Lubinsky, a professor of psychology and human development at Vanderbilt University. He spoke with Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett back in November. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut, best of version of the show. Coming up next, how volunteers in Nevada are tracking wild horses and injecting them with birth control. They say it's a more humane approach to managing the herd. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Julie Rose. Across 10 western states, about 88,000 wild horses and burros roam free. More than half of them are in Nevada, where an animal rights advocacy group called the American Wild Horse Campaign has undertaken an impressive volunteer effort to inject mares with contraceptives. They see it as a more humane approach to managing the wild horse population. The Bureau of Land Management's primary method is to round up horses with helicopters and pay people to adopt them. Investigations have shown some of those adopted animals end up being sold to slaughterhouses, which the BLM says should not be happening. But the BLM also says that widespread contraception of wild horses is also potentially very costly and not something realistic. Suzanne Roy directs the American Wild Horse Campaign, and we spoke with her in January about how her group is going about it. Why does the wild horse population need to be reduced at all?
Well, the wild horse population needs to be managed. I mean, to put this in perspective, if you travel to the West, you will be lucky to see a wild horse. They're on a very small fraction of our public lands, and their numbers are not great, large, compared to other wildlife species or cattle and sheep that live in the public lands. So they don't need to be substantially reduced, but they do need to be managed, because they're not allowed to live under natural situations. They live on lands where predators are removed. They're confined in artificial boundaries of herd management areas. Those are habitat areas that have been established and many times have cut them off from their historic migratory routes. So they have to be managed. And then the question becomes, how do you manage them humanely? And
hold on, one second. Yeah. Before we get to the how,
yeah,
they have to be managed. Why, though? Why can't they just be allowed to grow? I mean, the problem is that there's nothing to keep the population in check. So at a certain point, there's not enough food for them in their area that where they live. It's a matter of the population just being too big for the landscape where they're restricted.
Population would become too big for the landscape because the mountain lions, the wolves, the apex predators that would keep their population in check in many areas are killed for the benefit of the livestock industry. And so we don't have a natural system. They also can't move from area to area when, you know, in the summer, the forage may be less plentiful and the winter, it can be more in another area or vice versa. They have to stay, they're fenced in basically to these habitat areas and they can't migrate freely. So they don't live under fully natural conditions. And that's why they do have to be managed.
Can you describe for us the area that your organization focuses on in Nevada? What does that habitat look like? And what do these horses look like?
Yeah. Okay. So they're, you know, great American Mustangs. They're horses. They look like horses, but Mustangs are kind of stronger and stockier than some other types of horses. There's a distinct look to the Mustang, and that's what these horses have. They're in an area, a 300,000 acre habitat in the Reno, Nevada area. It's mostly private land. So they range on, for example, the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center, where some big tech companies are now. The Tesla Gigafactory is there, and Google and Switch and blockchains, a bunch of tech companies who are all very supportive of protecting the horses. And
so wait,
know,
these tech, so you've got these
land.
You've got these tech companies then who have their big data centers or whatever it is that they're doing out there in the mountain desert. And then like you could just be sitting at your boardroom window and kind of look out and there's like wild horses running around out there.
Yeah, it is. It's true. That's exactly the situation. Huh. And a lot of these companies have really embraced that and they consider it part of the brand that's attracting businesses to this area. Mm-hmm. They say it's not New York. It's not San Francisco. It's the real West and it's Nevada and they do see things. They're independent and the Mustangs are kind of symbols of that.
And so how did the horses get there?
The horses are really embraced. How did they get there?
Yeah.
Well, they've been there they got there the way all the wild horses got there. You know, the horse as a species evolved in North America and it went locally extinct and was reintroduced by the Spanish explorers in the 1500s. And so the horses out there today are, some of them are descendants of, you know, the Spanish colonial horses and others are descendants of ranch horses. And other types of horses that were brought over to work the land or even bred to send to war and then were turned loose. And they became highly adapted to the environment and thrived because this is where the horse as a species evolved. So the origin of the horse is varied.
Let's talk about management then. So the how to manage the population since the natural predator pressure doesn't exist. The Bureau of Land Management, as I mentioned, at the Department of Interior has a responsibility for managing the population. What has been their traditional tool, the agency's traditional approach to managing?
Yeah, right now the government, the Bureau of Land Management, uses the most inhumane and the most expensive method for managing wild horses, and that's helicopter roundups. They send helicopters out into these remote regions where the wild horses live, and they chase them out of the hills. They stampede them for miles over difficult terrain in extreme temperatures. And then they basically run them into a trap. And it's a very sad situation to see these wild free roaming animals lose their freedom like that. And in addition to being, you know, wild and free, they are very tightly bonded animals. They're very social and they have strong bonds with their family units. And once they hit that trap, they never see their family members again.
What happens to them in the trap? They're trapped, yeah, and so then what?
They're loaded onto trailers and they're shipped to holding pens. And some will be adopted and some will be maintained. A larger number will be maintained for life at taxpayer expense.
So just on government-run pastures and corrals where these...
Corrals and pastures, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they live out their days, but you feel like that's not humane because of the emotional trauma that the Roundup causes the horses?
Well, they're wild free roaming animals. They've evolved to live a certain way on the land, and when you put them into captivity, they don't get to express the natural behaviors that they've come to evolve to exhibit. And so they don't get to live in the social structure that wild horses live in. And they're not free roaming anymore. And I mean, we wouldn't like take round up all the deer and put them in pens and the elk or other wild animals. And so it's really no different for the horses.
Why don't people go out and round them up and train them and sell them? I mean, horses are valuable, aren't they?
Well, the problem is that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, does have an adoption program. But they're removing horses in numbers, greater numbers than they can adopt out. Mm. And so what really has to happen, I mean, the National Academy of Sciences looked at this management approach and they called it expensive and unproductive for the federal government and the public because we're paying for it. And they recommended instead of rounding up and removing horses from the land, let's manage them humanely on the land and address reproduction. So we're not, allowing them to produce all these horses that will get removed and cost.
The problem
costs
though,
$100 million a year right now.
It costs how much did you say?
$102 million.
Okay. The current management system. So the problem with
them on the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I mean, managing them on the land, though, through reproduction means administering birth control, contraception,
correct,
to the females, which how do you chase down a female Mustang and give her birth control? That seems like a pretty tall order. How is your group doing that?
Well, first of all, it's delivered remotely by a dart gun. So you can be anywhere from 15 to 60 yards from the animal when you dart her. And it really just takes getting out and learning about the horses, where they are, where their water sources are, what their foraging patterns are, and then devising a plan to dart them. The horses are darted when they're grazing. What horses will do is they come into water once or twice a day, and then they'll move off and start grazing. And that's when our darters are able to dart them because they're kind of distracted because they're grazing and socializing. And
is one shot, is one dart enough to have contraception for life for a mare?
Oh, no. Right now it's an annual thing. There are studies ongoing of a immunocontraceptive vaccine that may offer permanent infertility.
But in the meantime, you have to be able to know which horses have gotten how many doses. And how do you do that?
Yeah, it's we have a big database of 3,000 horses, which is about the population out there in the Virginia range. And so we identify them individually by photograph. And when a darter goes out, they will look at a horse. They'll identify a mare, and they'll say, they'll look in the database for her based on her color, her markings, and her social affiliation. And they'll pull up her file, and they'll see if she needs to have a shot. The other thing is, after 3 to 5 vaccines, 3 to 5 shots, you know, 3 to 5 years of vaccination, the mare will likely become permanently infertile. So it's not like you have to do it for their entire lives.
You've been at this for a couple of years now, your group. I think this last year was the second year that you had been doing the darting. So what percentage of the population in this specific range have you been able? It seems like you'd have to get a lot of them vaccinated in order to really start reducing the managing the population. Have you gotten to the threshold where you feel like this could work?
Yeah, we have. What you want to do is you figure that in a wild horse population, approximately 40% of the animals will be reproductive age mares. And so you want to get at least 80% of the reproductive age mares in order to have an effect population wide. And we are at that level at this time in the Virginia range. Our volunteers have delivered over 3,000 treatments to 13, I think we're close to 1,400 mares now. And we are at that threshold where we believe we will be seeing a population wide effect.
But that you'll have to wait and see after birthing season, the next couple of seasons to see.
Yeah, we'll start to know this birthing season, which starts in March, and then the following one.
And this is this is very hands on. You've got volunteers doing it. Is it less expensive than the other approach that the BLM is doing?
Much less expensive. The BLM estimates that it would cost $2,500 a mare to vaccinate her. That's because they're talking about using helicopters and rounding up entire bands and then vaccinating mares. We do it for approximately $143 a mare.
That's Suzanne Roy, Executive Director of the American Wild Horse Campaign. I spoke with her back in January. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Every week, the Top of Mind team combs through our archives to select conversations that deserve another listen. Great to have you with us. This hour, when homework actually does more harm than good. Also, a closer look at the program in Eugene, Oregon that's inspired cities all around the country to start sending crisis workers instead of armed police officers for some 911 calls. Then, only a handful of people have ever been into the dangerous caves beneath Greenland's ice sheet. We'll meet one of them coming up on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Families are getting back into the school groove, carpools and extracurriculars and homework, of course. Do you wish your kids were bringing home less homework or maybe more? If they don't have any homework, are they really learning as much as they could be? Stanford's Challenge Success Program has long been studying the value of homework, when it's helpful, and when it actually harms kids. Denise Pope is one of the founders of Challenge Success. She's a senior lecturer at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education, and I spoke with her last fall. What's an example of homework being harmful to a student?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the sheer load of homework alone can be harmful. There are a lot of consequences when you have too much homework. You may not sleep at the usual time that you go to bed. You may stay up too late. And if this persists, it can lead to sleep deprivation, which we know is associated with mental health issues. And we also know that an overload of homework can lead to stress. Too much stress is not a good thing. It can cause anxiety. It can cause maybe even lead to depressive episodes. So too much homework is not a good thing. Homework that's too difficult and you can't do it can also lead to those outcomes.
How much is too much?
Great question. It's sort of like the Goldilocks problem. That's what we say in our paper, that you want to assign just enough, but not too little and not too much. And that really may depend on the kid. It may depend on the subject area, if they understand what's going on. It may depend on the age. We have a rule of thumb that is at the high school level, pretty much the research shows anything over 2 hours is too much and not as effective and not related to academic achievement and can actually impact some of the sleep and mental health issues that we talked about. In middle school, it's about an hour, hour and a half. Again, for some kids though, that might be way too much and put them over the edge. So you really have to know the child.
What about elementary school?
In elementary school, there hasn't been great research. Most of the research shows that there's no correlation between any homework whatsoever in elementary and academic achievement. There are some people that have extrapolated down from the 2 hours and 90 minutes, 2 hours in high school, 90 minutes in middle school. So they take what's called a 10-minute rule in elementary school. If it was 90 minutes in ninth grade, then it should be 10 minutes in first grade. There's not good research about that, but there are some schools that use that little rule of thumb.
But surely there's always some benefit to a student taking what they've learned in class and then going home and practicing it.
Not in elementary school, actually.
Okay.
It turns out that practice can be done in school and doesn't have to be done outside of school. And sometimes if you go home and try to practice and you're not understanding what you're doing, that's not considered good practice. That's actually harmful practice. So we would prefer that the practice happen in school or with the ability to make sure that the kids know what they're doing. We also tell students and teachers, maybe you want to get started on homework in school with the teacher watching so that they can make sure that you're doing it correctly and not going to go home and either panic, need a help of an adult who may or may not be able to help you for a whole bunch of reasons, or just get it wrong.
So how are you thinking, Professor Pope, right now about families? And let's talk first about elementary age children who are, many of them are in states or districts where maybe their kid only sees their teacher in person every other day, not for a whole day necessarily. And then they're spending the other days of the week, you know, doing assignments and maybe checking in on Zoom. And there are some kids who are doing, you know, Zoom check-ins, and that's it. They don't actually see their teacher in person because of pandemic restrictions. How are you thinking about practice and learning when a child isn't sitting in a classroom for 6 hours a day, every day of the week?
Right. Great question. So the pandemic has really blurred the lines between what has traditionally been known as homework, which takes place after school, usually not in school, and what is just considered school assignments. And unfortunately, right now, many, many students can't tell the difference, right? Because it just all starts to blur. It all looks like homework to them. So what we know has to happen is in any situation, whether it's in school or out of school, the work that you give kids has to seem meaningful. It has to have a purpose. It can't seem like busy work. And you want to engage the students in as much as possible with the work that they're doing. So whether that's in school, whether that is during the pandemic and it's during remote learning or hybrid, all of these assignments, we need them to have purpose. We need the students to understand the purpose and the value. They need to be able to do it independently. And it should not take over some of the other things that we know kids need to be doing right now: sleeping, having time for play, having time for exercise, having time to spend with family and friends.
A couple of things there that you mentioned, Professor Pope. First of all, you just said it needs to be work that the child can do independently. And I'm sure parents listening, anyone who has elementary age kids, just scoffed out loud at that, because even homework, even in the olden days, homework could rarely be done independently. Parents always have to be engaged, it feels like. Can you describe for me a scenario where a third grader would actually be able to accomplish homework or classwork independently?
Sure. So I want you to think of it as sort of a sports analogy. We use this analogy a lot. When it comes to homework, parents should cheer from the sideline. They should get them all the equipment. They should buy the soccer cleats and whatever is needed. they should get them in the metaphor, then you get them a quiet place, you get them the materials they need, you get them a schedule where they know that this is the time that I do homework. Maybe you set a timer. But when it comes to the actual work itself, and a third grader knows how to read, right? They should be able to do it without a parent standing over their shoulder. Now, it may be that you have a kid who has ADD or ADHD. You may have a kid who's reluctant to get started. Of course, every kid, you know, many, many kids are like that with homework. But when they actually do sit down, when they actually do put pen to paper, the parent really should not have a role. That should be between the teacher and the child.
You also said it's important that the homework or classwork, whatever the student is doing outside of a classroom right now, should not feel like busy work. Doesn't all homework feel like busy work on some level for kids? Like busy work is in the eye of the beholder.
Busy work is in the eye of the beholder. However, when you get kids excited about learning, it doesn't feel like drudgery. So the trick is to figure out what it is that's going to get them at least to see the value and purpose. They may not love everything that they do. We have ways of looking at what we call engagement, where there's affective engagement. Do they like it? Are they enjoying it? But there's also behavioral engagement. Will they do it? But the most important one is cognitive engagement. Do they see the value and the purpose? They may not love doing some of the math problems, but they know that if they do that, it's going to be better for them in the long run. And they see how it ties into sort of the real world, right? So why do we need to learn math? Well, when you're cooking a recipe and you want to just make it just for you and not your whole family, you're going to need to do some math to cut that recipe in half. All of a sudden, you've just helped them understand why they need to do fractions and how fractions are used in real life. And it doesn't seem like this sort of boring, rote, mechanistic thing that's just on a worksheet.
So it's a matter of how the teacher frames the assignment. The teacher needs to start with a clear justification for why this particular assignment in this particular format. And then that has to be communicated. You can't just know it's a good assignment and hand it off to the kid and expect that they're going to be engaged in it.
Exactly. And the teacher has to know the kid enough to know about what's going to interest them. So if it's not cooking with fractions, maybe it's sports with fractions, right? And you look at, batting averages and statistics and whatnot. So there's also this sort of sense of what is developmentally appropriate for a third grader and what is this particular third grader interested in? And can we give them some what we call voice and choice over the assignment?
Even if
it's just, you can pick these three problems to do from this section, and then you can pick another three problems from the next section, even little tiny choices ups engagement.
But teachers are already having trouble having one-on-one engagement with students, especially if they're spending a lot of time remote or if they have limited time to actually be with children in the classroom. That just seems really difficult for the teacher to be able to have a one-on-one conversation with every child, justifying, here's why this particular math assignments today matters for you.
I know. Well, and it doesn't have to be with every individual child. So what we know is let's take the third grade example. We've taught third grade for several years. We kind of know the themes of what the kids come in interested in. You're kind of aware of the latest trend or pop culture or, Pokemon Go or whatever it is. So the teachers, that's part of what makes a teacher great, is they sort of understand these things go in waves and they will build that in. And then if you see one or two kids who are really not interested, then you're not having to do it with all 30 of your students or 70 of your students if you're in middle school or 100 if you're in high school. You have to just understand sort of the developmental needs of your kids at that age group, and also sort of what makes them excited or interested. You can do that with a simple survey or poll. I surveyed my grad students before class this quarter to find out what they're interested in and what kind of music they listen to and what they're reading. And so I try to slip in examples from different ones as I'm teaching the class.
What are your thoughts on homework for the older kids, the middle schoolers and high schoolers, who many of them also are doing a hybrid of in-person and online and clearly not having as much time in the classroom where the teacher can sort of wrangle their attention and help them to be engaged in the hard drudgery of learning?
Well, we like to think of learning as not drudgery, if at all possible. And I know that not every class is going to get every kid excited, but hopefully you have one class that you're excited about or one assignment or project that you're excited about. But when it comes to older kids, we also are trying to help them advocate for themselves. In other words, if something's taking a really, really long time, we want the teacher to be able to say to this older child, hey, listen, this assignment should take about a half hour. If you find yourself working long after that, you need to stop, write a note, and let me know. And that's really hard for kids to do because it seems like they're doing something wrong or maybe the teacher will lower their grade. But the teacher is very serious that they need to know. They can't possibly know how long an assignment takes every kid. Different kids read at different speeds. Different kids understand things differently. You might get stuck on the first problem and it takes you so long that you never even see the other ones that you might have been able to do. So we are asking students and parents of younger students to really advocate for themselves and let teachers know, particularly because they can't see what's going on.
Should homework be a major part of a grade for middle schoolers and high schoolers right now in particular, do you think?
Very controversial. So we have seen schools really change their grading practices since the pandemic. A lot of schools in the spring said we will do no harm with the grade. So whatever grade you had coming into March 2020, it can only go up. It can't go down. We had schools change to just pass fail, you know, credit, no credit. With homework, the trend these days is to use homework to help you understand a topic, to help you practice the skills, to help you maybe learn the material, but not necessarily use the homework itself as an assessment. So we have lots of teachers who are experimenting with ungraded homework or just it's credit or no credit. But here's the thing about grading homework. You don't know what resources are happening or not happening at home. So it actually is, it can be that students don't have access to a computer or they don't have access to a parent to help them if it's not something they can do independently. And so when you're grading the homework, you actually have to realize that there's some kids who don't have control. There's reasons beyond their control. And that's why they're turning it in with mistakes or not turning it in at all. So a teacher has to take that into account if and when they're giving feedback. There are some schools since the pandemic that have said, we're not going to give homework, homework in the traditional sense. So maybe they are meeting online synchronously, or maybe you're going to school in a hybrid fashion. And they basically say to the students, if you're with us from 8 to 3, after that time, you are free to go and basically do what it is you need to do. There have been teens who have had to take on extra jobs because of the pandemic. There are teens who have to take care of younger siblings, take on extra chores. And the schools are understanding that we're in a pandemic and you can't be focused 24/7 from 8 to 3 and then again for 2 or more hours after school. So we've seen schools that have said, okay, we're going to greatly reduce or eliminate homework because of the pandemic.
Denise Pope is a senior lecturer at the Stanford University Graduate School of Education, one of the founders of Challenge Success. I spoke with her about a year ago. Not an awful lot has changed when it comes to education and the pandemic. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes on this director's cut of the show, meet one of the few people ever to climb into the caverns below Greenland's ice sheet. Just ahead, we'll speak with the coordinator of a program in Oregon that's now the model for cities all around the country, looking to shift the role of police officers in responding to 911 calls. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. We're pleased to have you with us today for this director's cut of the show. I'm Julie Rose. In many communities across the country, calls to defund the police have boiled down to a discussion about the best role for armed officers. Do they really need to be making mental health checks or responding to complaints about homelessness? Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Denver, Portland, and D.C. are some of the cities now experimenting with an approach pioneered in Eugene, Oregon, which deploys crisis workers instead of police for some 911 calls. The program in Eugene has been running for 30 years. It's called CAHOOTS. And last summer, I spoke with Benjamin Brubaker, who is co-coordinator of the nonprofit White Bird Clinic, which runs CAHOOTS for Eugene, Oregon. Let's listen. Explain the logistics of this to us. A call comes into 911. Who decides if it's something for the police or for your organization to handle?
Well, we work closely with our law enforcement partners and public safety partners to refine dispatch protocols. So ideally, it's a protocol that's designed with both our agency and them working together to figure out what are the right types of calls that we should be going to. If there is any question, we'll sometimes even dialogue directly with dispatchers about the appropriateness of a call. And we also, because we're dispatched through the Eugene Police, Springfield Police Department's dispatch, occasionally we'll hear calls go out and we'll note, hey, you know, we know that person or that kind of sounds like something we could assist with, and we'll either stage in the area or occasionally take that call.
What would be a typical, what are the majority of the calls that your team goes out on? I mean, I mentioned they would be nonviolent. What does that typically consist of in the majority of calls?
Well, I'd say it's a really wide variety of stuff. It could be an intoxicated individual that's out in public. That also could be an individual that's simply just having some behavioral health issues and needs somebody to come and support them and figure out some alternatives. It could be an individual that is sleeping somewhere in public or is otherwise in a public area that has people concerned about them. A lot of our calls are actually people requesting counseling for themselves, for their loved ones, for their friends, or even a neighbor that they're concerned about, to go out and maybe do what we call a welfare check and make sure they're okay, or to even just go out and offer crisis support services and then try to connect them into appropriate social service supports.
Of all the calls that come in on 911 for Eugene or Springfield, the two towns there that you serve, cities rather, what percentage of them ends up with just your crisis workers going and no police actually responding at all?
You know, I don't know what the exact number is on that. We handle anywhere from, we estimate 17 to 20% of the call volume that comes through the police non-emergency dispatch. And out of those, only a very small fraction of them do we ever require some assistance from police and actually call them back in. And there are many calls that actually start with some initial officer contact, either because the scene didn't seem totally safe or maybe we weren't immediately available and it needed a quicker response. But many of those calls are pretty quickly passed to us once we're available or it becomes clear that the scene is safe and it's more appropriate for a COOTS response.
Police officers will willingly hand off the situation to you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we have worked very carefully on over the last 30 years is developing that relationship. And it didn't start off perfect by any means. There was some mistrust a little bit, maybe on both sides, as we started this project 30 years ago, from what I hear from folks that were around then. But at this point, yeah, there are officers. We hear from our law enforcement partners here locally and across the country that many of them are tired of being the de facto mental health response, the behavioral health response, that they're left picking up the pieces of our broken medical and both behavioral, physical healthcare systems. And they know that that's not what many of them joined law enforcement to try to solve. So having a social service that's able to go out and respond and assist in these situations is pretty crucial. They are more than happy to clear those things when it's non-criminal in nature,
so,
and be able to then pass it to us.
So how are your crisis workers equipped when they go out on a call?
I mean, as far as equipment goes, we have a crisis worker and an EMTB, a basic EMT or better. So we come equipped with some basic first aid, wound care, other kinds of emergency medical supplies up to that level of care. And then our crisis workers are coming equipped with at least 3 years kind of behavioral health care experience, working with people with those kinds of issues, as well as up to like 500 hours of training under their belt. But other than that, some gloves, a clipboard, maybe a notepad.
No taser, no mace, no gun.
No weapons at all.
Huh.
We're a voluntary service. And part of what speaks to how we've been able to be safe and have no kind of hospitalization, serious injury in the 30 years is that we are really clear that we're a voluntary service. We're there to assist. We're human beings trying to help human beings. And if they don't want us there, we're going to leave. You know, and if they need a higher level of care, there are risks to themselves or others. We are mandatory reporters and we'll assist in spinning up that next level of response. But a lot of times once people recognize that we're only there to help them if they want us there, that starts to build rapport and actually, I think, creates a lot more safety for our workers.
And I want to be clear, when you say you're a voluntary service, you mean that that it's optional. When you respond, somebody somebody can say, no, I don't want you here, and you guys will leave. Is that right? You're not saying that all of your crisis workers are volunteers? They're paid,
no.
Right? Okay.
No, all of our staff is paid. No, by voluntary service, I mean that we really, believe in empowering people to make decisions for their own care and what they need. And if they decide that they don't want us there, we're going to leave. And we may stay for a moment to try to chat with them, see if we can get them to open up or warm up to us. But in general, if they make it clear that they just don't want to talk, we're going to leave.
So your crisis workers have no power to arrest people. Can they restrain someone if the person gets physically out of control?
No, we call for our law enforcement partners to back us up. And because they know that we're unarmed, they come very quickly to assist us. And again, it's a very small fraction of calls that we ever really need that kind of response. Hmm. But when we do, they come quickly.
And your crisis workers have never felt the need to be armed. Their own safety is not a concern.
Well, I wouldn't say their own safety is not a concern. We train heavily on what's about scene safety and how to keep yourself from having tunnel vision and keeping your eyes up and focused on the entire environment and how the person's acting and what they're saying. And if they start feeling like things are getting unsafe, they're going to, again, leave that call or call for appropriate levels of assistance. And that's part of what keeps them safe. But, you know, and I would also say it's a testament to the way that we work with dispatch to really make sure that we have appropriate protocols up front that help ensure our safety.
Do you come with an ambulance to transport people to the hospital?
We are a transporting agency. We're not an emergency medical transport, but we are able and have a compartment in our CAHOOTS vans where we can transport folks to appropriate services, including at times the ER, although we try to get people to more appropriate services because we know the ER is overutilized and not always the best place for somebody to get help. Mm. But we're able to do those kinds of transports. If somebody's in need of emergency medical care, we also are, again, wired into the dispatch in a way that we can get them an emergency response from an ambulance if that becomes necessary.
I'm speaking with Ben Brubaker, who is the clinic co-coordinator at Whitebird Clinic in Eugene, Oregon, which operates this program. It's called CAHOOTS. I don't know if we've mentioned the name yet, but this is a program that sends crisis workers out instead of police to deal with nonviolent situations in the community, 911 calls that may come in where it's deemed appropriate. What does CAHOOTS stand for, by the way, Ben?
Crisis assistance helping out on the streets.
Excellent.
But
okay.
Building on our rapport in the community, we were able to have a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek. We're kind of in cahoots with the police right here, but we're not the police.
Yeah.
You know, we're working with them to try to help you so that they don't have to be involved.
Would you let us be a fly on the wall for a moment in a hypothetical call that you've worked as a crisis worker, I presume? You've gone out on some of these calls
Yes.
yourself. Okay. So you get called in. Let's say it's somebody who's intoxicated and behaving in a way in public that somebody called 911. So you go out on this. How would that go down? How do you introduce yourself? How long would you spend there? What would the end goal be to get that person? I mean, the police would show up and they'd probably send them to jail for the night so that they sober up, right? What's your end result typically in a situation like that?
Well, so to start, when we first step out with somebody, we're really trained in a non-judgmental, meeting people where they're at kind of approach. So we're not going to show up as the know-it-all professional and be immediately judging the person for whatever coping skill they've decided to use that day in order to deal with their day and with whatever other things they have going on. We're going to step out and meet them as one human being to another and try to not have any judgment towards their decisions that may or may not have led them into this particular situation. We also are going to avoid using what we call the pseudo-professional affect, which is the, oh, hi, how are you? I'm so happy to see you today, which everybody sees right through. All of us that are listening see right through that, and especially the folks we serve. Instead, mm-hmm. we're going to be like, hey, how are you doing, man? Like, some folks are worried about you. What can we do for you today? Can we help you? Like, you know, and then we're going to start assessing, like, how safe is this person? Are they able to ground themselves out? Do they have friends nearby or friends we can kind of help them reach that could help support them that day? Are they able to interact with us because wherever their level of intoxication might be, are they able to track enough to be able to really interact with us and make a plan for how they could get into a better situation? Are they going to be safe? Maybe this is a call that didn't even need to come in because ultimately the person is a little bit intoxicated, but they're able to really maintain themselves in a way that they don't need to go to any other place or they don't need further supports. In Eugene, we also have the advantage in this particular call type of having a sobering center. It's been gone here more recently because of COVID concerns, but we hear that it's coming back soon. But that's a non-criminal sobering center. So if the person's willing, we'll be like, hey, let us take you somewhere safe. You don't have any friends, you don't have any, or that you can get a hold of right now. You don't have any other place to go. Why don't we like help you get over there and get to a place where you can get some soup, some juice, lay down, sober up a little bit. And that'll be how that goes. If the individual is unable to care for themselves, unable to track, seems like they're going to maybe stumble into traffic and be a risk to themselves or others, we may then ask for further supports if they seems like they can't or don't want to interact with us.
Hmm. Okay. And then you leave. So that could take, I mean, I guess that could take a couple hours, depending on how it goes or how well the person is able to communicate. You spend as long as you need, and then do you do any follow-up afterwards? Does this person end up with their name in the system somewhere as having had your crisis response?
You know, one of the things is we're trying to start helping other cities consult around this. It really goes back to that we really recommend that they create a similar structures in other communities to what we have, which is a third party outside human service provider that contracts with public safety or with the cities to provide the service. What that does is it means that we don't have to openly share our records with anyone, which gives each individual we treat a sense of confidentiality and privacy. Mm-hmm. If we're court ordered to share records, then we will do so per HIPAA laws. But in general, know that won't result in them somehow being logged into the system because it's non-criminal again in nature. And we're just trying to help get them to a better support.
So your advice for other cities thinking about trying to divert some of these emergency calls to someone other than the police, your advice is that it not be another government agency that's operating this service, that it be some organization like yourself, like the White Bird Clinic, which is a nonprofit, totally separate.
Yeah, I really think that helps both with the, I think that's going to help with kind of cultural pieces that are necessary for this. Each community is going to have a different kind of diversity to it that hopefully these services will represent that kind of diversity. And it also keeps it out from underneath the government umbrella so that they have that sense of privacy that each individual can have. And because that's really a big part of us building rapport with individuals is explaining we work with the police, we work with the city of Eugene, but we're not a government agency. Everything you say to us is protected by healthcare privacy information laws.
There's a lot of talk right now about finding alternative programs like your own to prevent unnecessary escalation in police encounters. You know, if you can send somebody who's not armed to deal with a homeless person who's sleeping in public or an intoxicated individual or someone who's having a mental health crisis, hopefully that will mean that there's obviously a lot less chance that that's going to escalate into some sort of police, police using lethal force in a situation like that. Have you actually seen that work? Do the numbers bear that out in your community that there's less of a problem with police use of force and situations escalating?
Well, it's difficult after 30 years of the CAHOOTS team in particular being around and 50 years of White Bird being around that also even early on worked closely to try to help divert some people in some of these types of calls to our agency and our 24/7 crisis line that we've been running for 50 years. It's hard to get a count on before or after effects. We kind of hope that as other cities spin up, that we might be able to see some more data come out of those cities to see if these kinds of models can be effective. My sense from the kind of work we do, from the feedback that we get from our community partners, including our law enforcement partners, is yes, I believe that this has an impact. Sending the right person to the right kind of call with the right type of training, I believe it can be very helpful in trying to create a more safe and more thoughtful public safety response.
Do you have less public intoxication, less homelessness as a result of this kind of a response?
Again, I think that the other thing that a lot of communities are going to have to wrestle with is looking at those other issues that may exist within their individual communities and really start looking at ways to find funding for the upstream causes of a lot of the issues that then are then kind of dumped, frankly, on our public safety responders, both EMS and law enforcement, because all of them, and us included, know that a lot of the brokenness within our existing systems that is not being addressed currently ends up just falling down onto what is a really expensive response when you're throwing EMS and law enforcement at all of these basic social issues that are really about human needs that are not being met in our communities. And that foresight piece to how we do public spending in general is a really difficult thing. You know, I know Utah's had some great success with the Housing First model, but we don't see we've had 30 years of data around Housing First working and decreasing costs, you know, for how to help these individuals. But we see it not being fully implemented across the country, across the world. And so even where there's good data and statistics to support a cost savings measure that requires some upstream spending, we're still seeing some communities being very slow to respond and really, you know, do those things.
That's Benjamin Brubaker, a co-coordinator at White Bird Clinic, which is a nonprofit that runs the CAHOOTS program in Eugene, Oregon, a model now for cities across the country looking to change the way their armed police officers respond to 911 calls. I spoke with Benjamin Brubaker in July of last year. This is Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up on this director's cut of the show, only a handful of people have ever been into the dangerous caves beneath Greenland's ice sheet. We'll meet one of them and find out what he saw. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind Prime Cuts today. I'm Julie Rose. Once a week, the Top of Mind team dives into the archives to select conversations we'd like to hear again. A couple hundred years from now, most of Florida, New York City, Boston, and other low-lying cities all over the world could disappear beneath water that has melted off of the planet's ice sheets and into the ocean. Antarctica and Greenland are the largest of those ice sheets. Glacier scientist and ice climber Jason Gulley is one of the few people on Earth who has been under Greenland's ice sheets. And he spoke with me earlier this year about what it's like down there. Gulley is a professor at the University of South Florida. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. Can you explain Greenland for us? It's an island, not a continent, right? Is it totally covered in ice?
That's right. So Greenland's a very large island, and the vast majority of it's covered in ice. There's a little bit of land around the perimeter, but most of the settlements are kind of isolated from each other. There are no roads. And when we talk about the Greenland ice sheet itself, it contains enough ice to raise sea level if it were to melt completely by about 7 meters.
Oh, which is like 21 feet or something like that. That's a lot of water. So how thick is the ice that covers Greenland?
So, you know, the ice on the margins is, you know, tens to hundreds of meters thick. And as we move into the interior, we're talking about ice that's kilometers thick. So, you know, some of the thickest ice on the ice sheet is more than 3 kilometers thick.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. And then what's underneath the ice?
So underneath of the ice is this crazy landscape. And again, it's not something that we understand very well, but scientists have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it looks like by flying airplanes with radar that's able to see through the ice and map out the landscape underneath. But there's like small mountain ranges. There's even like a Yellowstone full of like hot springs and stuff that are located under one part of the ice sheet.
Wow.
And very, very deep valleys. So parts of the ice sheet are on land that's above present day sea level. Other parts of the ice sheet are actually on land that's far below sea level.
And what is it that you have been trying to figure out about the ice on Greenland?
So what I study is some relatively recently discovered links between the melting and the motion of the Greenland ice sheet. And, you know, when we talk about the Greenland ice sheet melting and what might happen in the future, we tend to think that as temperatures warm up, it's like a big giant hunk of ice and it's going to melt a little bit more. And that's absolutely going to happen. But the other thing that happens is that meltwater flows in rivers on the surface of the ice sheet and it disappears into these enormous holes called moulins. These moulins are vertical shafts or giant caves that connect rivers on the surface of the ice sheet to the bed. And when all of that water flows into the moulins, it's transported through over a kilometer of ice in some places to the base of the ice sheet. And that water spreads out and it lubricates the motion of the ice sheet. So that in summer, portions of the ice sheet are moving 100 to 200% faster than they are in winter when meltwater is not being delivered to the base of the ice sheet.
So the water, the sun heats up the surface water, the surface of the ice melts it. But instead of that water flowing in rivers straight, like rivers in the ice, open air, straight to the ocean, you say it drops inside, like it flows in rivers that then like turn into waterfalls and tunnel into the ice rather than flowing straight to the ocean.
That's right. Nearly every single river and meltwater stream on the ice sheet ends in one of these caves. And it's a type of landscape that we actually find like in non-glacial environments too, called karst on limestone, where you'll have rivers that disappear into caves that take, you know, tens of thousands to millions of years to form. We have these same types of processes that are happening on the Greenland ice sheet that are forming caves every year. And we'll have caves that'll form over a period of days to weeks that swallow entire lakes and rivers.
Hmm. And you have, over the last couple of years, been rappelling down into these moulins, these vertical ice caves. Tell us what it's
That's
like.
Right.
What's it like to be inside one of those?
For a couple of years, we had been trying to measure the water level fluctuations in the moulins. So we'd fly out onto the ice sheet and we'd set up these big camps and we'd try to lower instruments that would allow us to measure the water level fluctuations. We'd basically take this big heavy cable with a sensor attached to it and feed it into a waterfall and try to get it down into these moulins. And what we were able to measure was, you know, the water level going up and down, but we never really understood what those water levels meant in terms of like volume or how big these caves could be. So,
Cause I want to make sure I'm visualizing this. So you've got on the surface, you've got a big old hole that you can see, and there's like a waterfall falling down into it. And you can see that it goes pretty deep and you can hear that it's like splashing up on more water. So you think that there's water down there, but it's unclear. Is it like a skinny test tube full of water or does it like open up into a giant underwater lake? Like that was the question you were trying to figure out.
That's exactly right. And, you know, these are super intimidating places in summer. You know, you've got massive amounts of water pouring into this giant hole and it's just loud. I mean, it's so loud that, you know, you have to yell to communicate with people. So what we needed to be able to understand if we wanted to figure out like how these things are forming and where they're forming and how they're going to affect water level fluctuations that affect how fast the ice sheet moves, we actually needed to understand how big they were. And it turns out there's no real good way to do that from the surface. You can't really fly a drone into these things because you'll lose signal as they disappear below the ice. You don't have GPS to communicate with the drone for navigation. And it's very difficult to transport all the lights that you need. So it turns out that the easiest way to actually figure out how big they are is to go into them. So that's what we did starting in October of 2018. And again, you know, this is, these holes turn out to be like over 100 meters deep and sometimes more tens of meters across. They're just big, massive, scary places.
Well, and you're, I guess you're hanging on ropes, right, as you go down. But is the ice secure? If it's melting, isn't it kind of touchy in terms of how secure you are if you're hanging off of it?
That's right. So in 2018, as part of a project that we did with Red Bull Media for a film called Beneath the Ice, we rappelled into these during summer and we were totally blocked by water. And we expected that was going to be the case. you know, we rappelled off the ledge. And again, there was just this massive waterfall that was pouring into the ice sheet. And we could look down, we could see down like another, you know, 60, 80 meters. And Will Gadd, the ice climber that I paired up with, one of the world's top ice climbers, rappelled down a little bit further, got totally blasted by spray, decided that it just wasn't safe for us to continue at that point in time. So we came back in October when the ice sheet is frozen solid on the surface and there's no meltwater pouring into it. And what that did was it gave us a lot of freedom to work inside of this moulin when there wasn't water pouring into it. And we were able to explore all the way down to the bottom to where it became completely full of water, about 100 meters below the surface. At that time, the original plan was for us to try to scuba dive and continue exploring further. But the cave that we were in was quite unstable and the walls were cracking and collapsing in places. And we were comfortable making short forays into the cave at that point in time, but we were uncomfortable with the idea of spending several hours trying to gear up and continue on with exploration underwater.
Eek. Okay, so 100 meters down, you rappelled down 100 meters, and at this point it's in the winter, so the waterfall has frozen over. You rappel down, and then is it liquid water down there, or was it a frozen lake, and you thought somehow you were going to like drill a hole in the ice and then dive down in there somehow?
That's right. It's kind of both, right? So the water inside the moulin is not completely frozen. So it'll freeze over on the surface in like a lid, kind of like a pond or something. But we know from geophysical studies of moulins that meltwater backs up into these things and it stays throughout the year. And the reason that that happens is because it actually takes a really long time to freeze large volumes of water, which is why things like the Great Lakes don't freeze completely solid. You'll get a couple of meters of ice on the surface. And then, you know, the ice melts again in the summer.
Oh, sounds like it'd be really scary to dive down there anyway. So you guys opted not to dive. Were you able to gather anything, though, at least by getting to the lake itself, to the underwater reservoir? What information did you gather?
Yeah, we were absolutely blown away by how big these things are. And so when we look at models that are used to simulate how water level fluctuations inside moulins affect how fast the ice sheet moves, the biggest that we've ever seen in a model has been on the order of about 3 meters in diameter. What we were finding was moulins that, you know, were tens of meters in diameter. And when we think about that in the context of like how much water we can store, it's basically going from something that the size of like a 55-gallon barrel to a swimming pool. Right. So, you know, we can store vastly more water inside of the swimming pool. So what we were able to do then was take some of these measurements that we made inside of the moulin and use it as a way of improving some of the hydrological models that I've been working on in development with my colleague, Matt Covington at the University of Arkansas, who is also involved in the exploration.
So do you think then that if you could dive to the bottom of that, these much larger under ice lakes, they're larger than you thought. It's like skinny at the top, then it opens up into this big lake reservoir in the ice sheet. But do you think that it remains that large? Like if you dove to the bottom of that lake, you would hit the surface of Greenland? Or would it like narrow back up into another like vertical ice tunnel to go down to the surface of Greenland?
Yeah. So we actually really... It's a very good question. And, you know, it's very much like what moulins look like. And it's one of those things where we don't actually really know. We have some ideas as to what they might look like. But, you know, again, I was surprised based on all of the work that I've done in glacier caves around the world for the past 15 years at how big moulins were. You know, this is one of those things that was really unique and exciting for me, having been exploring caves and glaciers around the world, that, you know, I can still be surprised by something. So I think that, you know, no matter what we do when we start exploring below the water table, we're probably going to be surprised by it. That said, actually scuba diving to the base of the ice sheet's probably never going to happen just because of the amount of water that we have to go through. We're talking about having to dive through, you know, maybe 800 meters of water or more. So, you know, physically as humans, like I'm able to teach diving as an instructor down to about 100 meters using a variety of different types of mixed gases. And that gets us down about 300 feet below the surface. You know, we still have like another 700 or 800 meters that we need to go of water that we need to go through before we can hit the base of the ice sheet. And ultimately, the only way that we're going to be able to get all the way down there is with some sort of remotely operated vehicle.
I see, like a scuba robot or something like that that could go down there. And what is that going to tell us? What does even just knowing that there are really large reservoirs in the ice in these moulins, what does that tell us about the state of the ice sheet on Greenland?
Yeah, so what we really need to be able to do is predict how much the Greenland ice sheet is going to affect future sea level rise. So right now, over the 20th century, sea level's risen somewhere by about 15 centimeters. Okay, but it's been speeding up and now it's going maybe about twice as fast. So we're looking at about 3.6 millimeters per year of sea level rise or so. And the Greenland ice sheet's contributing about 0.7 millimeters per year. And we know this because we're able to make measurements. If we want to predict what's going to happen under climate change scenarios, we need a model. And the only way that that model is going to be meaningful is if we understand exactly like what physical processes are occurring on in the ice sheet. So if we want to look at these links between the hydrology and the motion of the ice sheet, say we know that the Greenland ice sheet speeds up by a certain amount as the ice sheet's melting under current scenarios as meltwater flows into these moulins and causes the ice sheet to speed up. What happens if we double the area of the ice sheet that's melting, or we double the amount of water that's flowing into the ice sheet? And if we want to do that, we need to understand how the plumbing of the ice sheet works. Mm. And, you know, to give an analogy, it's like if we wanted to understand what would happen to a city's storm sewer system, if we were to double the amount of rainfall that the city gets, we'd actually need to have a map of what the storm sewer looks like. Right now, what we're trying to do is understand what's going to happen in the Greenland ice sheet's natural storm sewer system, but we have no idea what that storm sewer looks like.
You've said a couple of times that the ice sheet is moving. So it's melting. The ice is melting, going into the moulins and then eventually working its way down to the surface. And then all of the ice on top of that running water is sliding? Is that what you mean by movement?
Sorry, that's correct. Yeah, so the Greenland ice sheet can melt just as like a big giant ice cube, but the ice sheet's also moving very much like a river, but a very, very slow moving river of ice. Mm. And the areas that we're working on are moving on the order of about 60 meters per year, much, much faster in summer when the ice sheet is melting and water is flowing into the moulins, and slower in winter. Other areas of the ice sheet are moving more than a kilometer per year.
Moving where? Where are they moving to? So
they're moving from the center of the ice sheet out towards the ocean. And as the ice sheet speeds up, it does two things. It moves ice from higher, colder elevations, where ice isn't melting as quickly, to lower, warmer elevations where ice can melt more. And then also for portions of the ice sheet that terminate in the ocean, as ice starts moving faster, it starts producing icebergs faster as well. So we're able to cause the ice sheet to move into warmer areas and melt faster, and also deliver icebergs directly into the ocean, both of which are going to contribute to sea level rise.
I see. And understanding where the water goes when it falls into these moulins, and whether it just goes straight to the bottom or if it like hangs out in these reservoirs, that helps you understand how surface melt is going to, in the future, affect how fast the ice sheet slides.
That's right. So right now, you know, based on our research and the research of other people, we know that, you know, meltwater is flowing into moulins and it's spreading out from those moulins and lubricating, you know, portions of the Greenland ice sheet. What we want to try to figure out is, all right, so first of all, can we replicate that behavior in a numerical model and then use it to predict what's going to happen as we start melting more and more of the ice sheet and moulins start forming in areas of the ice sheet and delivering meltwater to portions of the ice sheet that have never been lubricated before?
And when do you think you're going to try and dive into one of these underwater lakes?
That's a tough one. We don't have any funding for diving right now, but you know, we're definitely working on that one.
In the meantime, you can hang out where it's a lot warmer in the University of South Florida, huh? It's a little funny that you guys would have a program focused on glaciers down there in sunny Florida.
Yeah, well, you know, when you spend, you know, 4 or 5 months a year freezing, it's kind of nice to come back and spend the rest of the year around palm trees.
Jason Gulley is a professor of geology at the University of South Florida. I spoke with him back in January. And that's it for Top of Mind Prime Cuts today. It's been great having you with us. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. You can listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app. Or ask your smart speaker to play the Top of Mind podcast. You can also email us. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is topofmind@byu.edu. And our website is byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.